Welcome back to Posting Through It. I'm your host, Jared Holt, and I'm excited this week, sitting co-host slash being the interview subject, an old friend of the show, an old friend of mine, Mike Hayden. How's it going?
It's going great. It's going great. Every day I get a little bit further away from reading Jones's text, and it feels good.
Well, we'll talk about that and more, but first off, how's it going? I saw that you recently got started up on Ghost, which is the same platform I use for my newsletter. Talk about that. What's it called? It's going to be a long night, right?
It's going to be a long night, which...
I think I've heard you say that to me several times.
It's definitely a hedonism. And I'm just looking for a space that is not Twitter at this point. I really had a tough time with Mastodon. I tried for a little bit, but it was just too confusing for me. And I don't think it's me being not with it or something. I really just think it's just
boomer
too,
tech support.
Yeah, I just didn't find it doesn't work for me. And I can try to go back there a little bit and post. I didn't even try promoting the Alex Jones stuff from there. That's one thing. I was in there for 3 seconds. I was like, nope, not doing this. And so I'm really like in a tough spot because I really am not enjoying what Musk is doing. It's not an act. I really can't stand it. I hate the navigation of the site. And obviously he's bringing back Carpe Donctum, which that was a red line for me because he's such a piece of shit. And and not like he's egregious or anything. He's just so annoying. He had to be suspended, in my opinion.
He's not funny enough to stay. You know, he could be everything he is. And if he was a little funnier, you might not look the other way.
It's the fact that he's not funny that is so egregious. But So I just started a newsletter just as a way for me to reach people at our home base. I don't know if I'm going to do podcasts with it or something. I'd think about it though. I definitely think about it. I got to see what my current schedule is like. You do it every 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, every other week, and then a newsletter in between. That's about a pace with my day job that I've found that I can keep up and not overextend myself and end up putting out garbage. But
yeah,
that's
I'm just
what
looking
works for me.
I'm looking for other ways to reach people because we're all kind of stuck on Twitter, unfortunately, because we didn't really, figure out ways. The other platforms are not great for promoting journalism. They're just not.
No, they have the same folly that every other alternative platform has, which is why most of them don't make it. It's just insular, and it is very hard to convince large numbers of people to drop one thing and go to another. But I definitely share the frustration. The Twitter under Elon Musk, especially this stuff about the API limiting.
Yeah.
As a researcher, that just pisses me off. It's just awful. What if I charged you money to do basic research with data that, to be totally clear, isn't amazing to begin with in every respect.
What he did with those Twitter files and things like that. We could do an entire episode on that, but it's very difficult for me to find the previous Twitter administration sympathetic, and he managed to do it because just the way he went about it with these folks is trying to find scandal where so often there isn't any. And
he tries to find scandal where I would argue in most of those cases what you're seeing is incompetence
or just
shifting around and not actually having hard policies for stuff they're trying to deal with.
Or just the process of understanding the responsibilities that they have, which they don't think they were equipped for that. And Twitter, throughout Twitter's history, it's they keep coming up on this thing. Wait a second, we're creating mutations here. What is this? Why are we dealing with Pizzagate now? And they just decided never to deal with that. it's just awful the way he's handled it.
Yeah. Alex Jones is still not there, apparently for personal reasons. We'll talk about Alex Jones in a minute. But first, I wanted to talk about something that you sent me this morning, which is from the New York Times Upshot. I guess it's a newsletter slash vertical. And it's essentially all about how polls are split, support for Donald Trump, both, you know, on his own and also, you know, if there is another contender against him in the primary ahead of 2024. Reading from the New York Times here, polls are exceptionally divided on Mr. Trump's support among Republican primary voters. In national surveys since last November's midterm election, different pollsters have shown him with anywhere between 25% and 55% of the vote in a multi-candidate field. That's right, a mere 30-point gap, which I think is a little bit of sarcasm from the Times here.
Yeah.
This article goes on to explain that polls using what's called probability samples, which they argue are more reliable or like a better gauge of actual support, are having Trump poll around a third of Republican primary voters saying that they would, you know, for sure vote for him. But by any measure, he is still underperforming compared to where he was in the 2016 primary. In 2020, there was no primary, of course, because he was incumbent. Yeah. And I'm kind of curious your thoughts, because it does, I think there's been sort of a lot of question in, capital M media, you know, big wonky media, if you will, over, you know, whether Trump's moment is gone or whether his influence on the GOP and that like death grip that he has still persists. And I mean, what does this kind of polling tell you, Mike? I mean, I'm curious your thoughts here.
So I think it's interesting because, for me, it's going to be Trump or DeSantis. And I think, you know, the question is like, how close is Ron DeSantis to Trump is like the real question there. And Nikki Haley, I don't know what she thinks she's going to do, but this party has become ultra nationalist in many corners and outright fascist extremely racist. I really don't see anybody like Nikki Haley getting anywhere or anything like that. So the question is like, how close is Ron DeSantis? And you see like Ron DeSantis is sort of posturing recently where he's been doing, you know, things like taking on the Black community directly, which is a huge political third rail, I think, usually. Trump was more to the side of that. And I think he's really trying to show the voters in this primary that Trump is weak. And I think he's right. I think Trump is weak. But I think we've been so reluctant to kind of say that because it's like we're so used to like, oh, Trump is dead. And then he bounces back and he bounces back. But I really think that there has been a steady decline in Trump's grip since January 6th. And these are folks that don't like to give up the process of doubling down. They just want to double down until they disappear. But the doubling down is getting weaker, I think, with Trump.
Yeah. And DeSantis has been, you know, extremely outspoken as soon as things started to swirl about him being a possible contender. It seems like every week he's coming out as the governor of Florida and, you know, handing down some arcane policy that, you know, supposedly gets to the, you know, if you ask them, the heart of the wokeness issue or some shit like that, right?
Right.
You know, as you mentioned, he's targeted the Black community very directly. Vanity Fair had this headline that you also sent me. Ron DeSantis successfully bullies the College Board into tailoring AP African American Studies to the needs of fragile white people, which is a hell of a headline. Mm-hmm. Essentially, his administration in Florida rejected this AP course on African American Studies, claiming that it lacks educational value. This is what he had to say about
it. On the side of indoctrination, we're going to decline. If it's education, then we will do this course. So when I heard it didn't meet the standards, I figured, yeah, they may be doing CRT. It's way more than that. This course on Black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that an important part of Black history is queer theory? That is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids. And so when you look to see they have stuff about intersectionality, abolishing prisons, that's a political agenda. And so we're on, that's the wrong side of the line for Florida standards. We believe in teaching kids facts and how to think, but we don't believe they should have an agenda imposed on them. When you try to use black history to shoehorn in queer theory, you are clearly trying to use that for political purposes.
So, like, this kind of assertion, I think, is, like, very characteristic of what DeSantis is doing. He is making no bones about his problem with teaching children anything about the history of, you know, queer movements, anything resembling a complete history of the civil rights movement, black liberation movement. And, you know, among the writers, according to the New York Times, that were, you know, removed from this curriculum were Kimberlé Crenshaw, Roderick Ferguson, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and bell hooks. So, you know, these sort of renowned authors for their insights and knowledge on the history of these movements, you know, just kind of ripping them out of the curriculum. And it is, you know, to me, it's very hard to see that as anything other than, to borrow a phrase from like the Dave Rubens of the world, like an Orwellian type of destruction of history, or at least an attempt to undermine it significantly in education, which is really alarming. I mean, even Trump didn't go that far, even if he may have wanted to or spoken about wanting to.
Yeah. So what you're talking about here is really, I'm very interested in, because I felt that DeSantis fucked up when he did this. I thought he made a huge mistake. And, you know, I've been waiting for him to make mistakes to overreach. And when you have, you know, people giving press conferences, you know, talking about lawsuits on the behalf of black students, that's not good optics. And it shows us there's a very big difference between DeSantis and Trump. Whereas Trump knew how to ignite kind of the racist base in the Republican Party, that, you know, ignite them and give them things to get worked up about to and get them, mobilize them to vote. This is a little bit colder and analytical kind of racism. This is like Josh Hammer type stuff, which is, I mean, he's a big DeSantis guy. He's like down in Florida himself. You mentioned Dave Rubin. He's part of that crew too. Both of them were there to brought over to like a kind of a tour by that Christina Pushaw woman in January 2022. So he's listening to a lot of these kind of Claremont types are advising him this academic racist crap. And that's why you wind up with this kind of academic thing. Whereas Trump would just be like, okay, there are these foreigners are trying to get into the country. And they're not like us, and they're a vague different race, but he would not go after American black people so directly. In fact, would at the same time pander with folks like, you know, Diamond and Silk and
rest in peace to a real one, Diamond. Yes. We miss you.
And also he'd be like, where's my African American, right, or whatever at his rally.
Yeah.
The effect of those things was not necessarily to get black people to like him. It was to make this racist contingent of the Republican Party feel okay about voting along racist lines, right? And what DeSantis is doing is Vidar Amran type stuff. And I don't think that for people who don't know, those are like the kind of intellectual white nationalist world. And it's not, in my opinion, it doesn't have a lot of popularity.
Yeah, not exactly taking things over. And I would also add the caveat that the intellectual white nationalist movement, intellectual should be understood with very large air quotes.
Yes.
I don't, not a whole lot of like really deep thought going on there.
Yeah. So DeSantis is essentially proving to, trying to prove to Trump's base that he can replace Trump, that he is bigoted enough to be the new Trump, and he may succeed. He may very well succeed because, like I said, Trump is weak. He's not weak for any of the reasons he should have been in the past. He's weak because now, you know, January 6th has come and gone, and the crest of his wave, I think, is really falling. And there's a lot of legal baggage and all kinds of other things. And what, you know, the cost of DeSantis getting there, the things he's going to have to do to prove that, you know, he's a sufficient replacement for Trump, may make him very vulnerable in a general election. You know, again, the Democrats don't exactly seem like they have their act together, so that makes me nervous, but that's a different story.
So another thing happening on the political right that you mentioned to me this morning has to do with Viktor Orban, who has been sort of the poster child among the religious right, the far right more generally. They look to someone like Orban, who leads Hungary in a very far right direction, you know, essentially represents, I think, what the authoritarian streaks that they hope that Trump would bring about, or that he did bring about, and sort of what they see the vision as. That you can look to their adoration of people like Bolsonaro as well in Brazil. Yeah. They advertise it very plain, sort of the direction they want to take the party. But this piece came out of Reason. I'm going to read from it. I'm going to be sort of jumping around here and there, but starts like this. Viktor Orban is a hero to American national conservatives. So when in January 2022, the Hungarian prime minister announced he would supplement price caps on fuel and mortgage rates by mandating that sugar, flour, sunflower oil, chicken breast, pork legs, and certain milk products be sold to customers at lower October 2021 prices, some of this anti-free market cohort celebrated his decisive action to, quote, protect families from inflation. But, what would Milton Friedman say, tweeted Compact magazine editor Sohrab Amari, mocking advocates of market economics. This was, quote, the party of the state for the win. Well, what do you know? Headline inflation in Hungary is currently the highest in the European Union, running up at a massive 24.5%, with food and power prices up 49% and 56% through December 2022. Fiddling with the relative price of goods has, predictably, done nothing to curb the inflationary forces of the Ukraine war, supply shocks, and excessive domestic stimulus. It has made the Hungarian central bank's job of curbing inflation more difficult, with mortgage, fuel, and food price freezes distorting the consumer price index that it targets. What has happened is that 50% of Hungarians report experiencing regular shortages of price-controlled food products. Supermarkets are rationing sales of covered goods, to which eggs and potatoes were added in November. There have been shortages of granulated sugar, chicken breasts, and pork legs, and retailers are struggling to meet regulations for minimum stock. So this sounds very wonky.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're about to sound super smart, like breaking down like the Hungarian economy.
Yeah, this is not, unfortunately, this is not the Bloomberg podcast. We will not be breaking down international economics here. But, you know, going on to read this article, it is from Reason magazine. So, of course, you know, their takeaway is along the lines of government stimulus is bad or government price control bad. But it does mention, you know, at least a bit how essentially the American far right is blaming refugees from Ukraine for pushing up prices in Hungary.
Yeah.
They are citing wrong numbers, fail to mention that a lot of the refugees have actually gone to Poland, which has a much lower inflation rate. So essentially their guy is down and they are blaming Ukrainian refugees for what is essentially a failed attempt to curb inflation in Hungary by their man, Orban. And I think it's kind of really telling that this is like the gut reflex is to be like, well, Ukrainian refugees, that's why this isn't working. It has nothing to do with, you know, our guy.
Yeah. What interests me so much about this, and the reason why I sent it to you, is they don't have a lot of models for this kind of hard right, you know, politics that they are promoting. They just don't have very much. They have Orban, they had Bolsonaro, he's out now. And they fought tooth and nail to try to keep him there with all these like you know, Matthew Chiarmond type Project Veritas people down there. I believe who was Jason Miller, who was one of the Trump people, was down there trying to, you know, spin Bolsonaro's loss before they had their own January 8th coup attempt.
Jason Miller is the guy who does like Getter, right?
Yeah, he was down in Brazil. The point is that they were invested to really try to keep Bolsonaro in power, because they just don't have a lot of the global community still favors, you know, does not like this kind of hard right authoritarian stuff. They don't want this Steve Bannon vision. Countries don't like it in general. And it's, you know, the emphasis on Orban has a lot to do with this idea that, well, it's worked here, right? It, never mind that they would have dismissed it, you know, if it were a left-wing argument, they would have dismissed it because the country's too small. They'd be like, oh, it's too small, it doesn't mean anything. Doesn't matter. They have put it all on Orban. All these kind of pseudo-intellectuals, these Josh Hammer type people, are just all over this world. The Claremont Institute, all these people connected to the Peter Thiel world. And I think they're going to get desperate in a big way if the Orban story falls apart. And this issue of the inflation, this is bad, because this is their very argument against Biden, right? That this, like, he's made the economy all warped out of shape, and you know, the only thing that can fix it is this kind of hard right authoritarian worldview. And here you have your model, your guy. And the country is starting to, you know, it's starting to show some real signs of distress.
It's almost as if there is a reason these kind of governments aren't all over the world or something.
Yeah, it doesn't work. it doesn't work on top of it being extremely cruel and everything else. And it serves the interests of only a small group of very corrupt people, which include many of the people that we cover. All the people that we cover. I mean, very few of them really believe it's going to make anyone's material interests better. They just believe that they can have access to the power that they want to have. It's a power grab.
It's just like how there's a global conspiracy to tell everyone that my invention of shoe nails is a bad idea. Nails in the shoes. They don't want you to have that. Why? Not because it's not comfortable, but there must be some other reason, you know?
Well, if you think somebody like a good example is like Mike Cernovich, right? Like, what are Mike Cernovich's politics? Like, what is it, right? And that's what that's the nature of this hard right authoritarian stuff. I don't want to go on a tangent about Mike, weird Mike, but, you know, it's like, what is he doing? He's like retweeting like Wall Street Playboy or whatever these things still. And like, he's just, you know, any kind of vague right wing swamp shit. And, kind of Project Veritas sting operation. I don't know. It's not an ideology that you can say like, okay, well, you put this together, like this is going to make people's lives better. All these things.
It's just resentment. It's like resentment, you know, in order to know what they don't like, but what, like, I couldn't tell you, like, gun to my head, James O'Keefe, what is his positive vision of a government? Like,
yeah.
Like, and so, if you gave him, you know, a pen to rewrite the Constitution, what would he do that would change people's lives meaningfully for the better?
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same thing with DeSantis, like, and his thing. He's very much in the Orban playbook as well. Just going after like enemies, dividing people up and things like that. There's a whole cottage industry of like pseudo intellectual people in this like Claremont world that are there to try to make it seem like something, to make it seem like there's a plan involved. And that it works, and they have pinned it all, because there's nothing else representative of it, on Orban and on Hungary, and the wheels are coming off the bus, and it's really going to make this a tough sell, I think, once they do, because they've been all in on Hungary. As you know, all these guys are making trips back and forth from Hungary. They did a CPAC Hungary.
Yeah, I mean, the religious right has been mixed up with this even longer than CPAC. I mean, they've been slobbering over Orban as long as I can remember.
Yeah, that goes back to your right wing watch days. Yeah, I mean, like, this is a very small country to go that far in on, right? And it's like they have really made it part of their branding. And when Hungary becomes a total disaster, boy, you know, it is not going to make them look good in whatever's left of the Republican Party.
Mike, let's talk about the Alex Jones tax. You and your colleague, Megan Squire, who is just absolutely brilliant, got your hands on text message records from conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. And at the time of the recording that we're doing now, you guys have posted 2 of 5 parts to come, a series of reported pieces based on those text messages. So first off, I just want to ask, you guys also have sort of like a part 0 that you published explaining sort of how you came across these texts and how you, you know, what you did with them. But can you summarize that a little bit for listeners? How the hell did you get copies of Alex Jones' text messages? I know that the copy of the phone that sort of came up during Alex Jones' trial, is that what you guys got?
So it's not like that. What they look like are PDFs of text messages, like just reams of text messages that are blue or green in the way your phone will do that with somebody who is on iMessage or not. And just that. And we wouldn't have access to the whole phone. We don't have things like Signal. We don't have whatever social media platforms he would have been using at that time, probably stuff like Parler or whatever. We don't have those access to that, just texts. Megan took those texts. She's wild, and ordered them into a PDF, which is numerical, and you know, it goes by number and by date and by the second. So I asked, can you do that? You know, early on, she's like, I can do that. You know, I was like, wow, you can do a lot of things. Pretty impressive. And so she's like, did that very, very quickly. I wouldn't even know how to do it. And it's like this one PDF. So the reason why, you know, I'm so proud of the story, I would never have got there without Megan. But the reason why I'm so proud of the narrative, I was able to kind of write through on the writing side, is because I'm able to see, thanks to Megan, who's messaging him. It's not just looking at the text with his wife, but looking at who is also messaging him in between this. And that's my favorite part of these stories, is sort of like he's in these crises and things like that. And then Milo Yiannopoulos is like messaging him about Roger Stone's book and things like that. Right. So that was what Megan did with those. And here's the good news for any folks who are journalists or just researchers or just interested. I am going to try to see if we can get an additional part, an addendum to it that explains how you can get the text messages yourself. But they've been entered into the public record. And I think it's going to take about 2 weeks or so for them once you file for them. And I don't know, I need to get instructions on how to do that yet. I've been so busy with our work. I haven't figured it out yet, but yeah, you can do that. And then you'll have access to them as well. They'll be redacted, certain things, which are common sense things you can't see. Our stories will be out already by then, but yeah. And as to how we got them, Mark Bankston, who is the attorney in that case, wanted to go to Southern Poverty Law Center, and I'm very grateful. But he also knew that we were not going to pull any punches. And that's why he made that choice. He wanted to have an impact on InfoWars.
So the first in the series, you and Megan examine what seems like is just complete hell that Alex Jones lives in day to day when he's not, you know, in front of the camera hollering about brain pills or whatever on InfoWars. And I gotta say, couldn't happen to a worse guy. It's hard for me to, you know, if I saw somebody, I think might have responded to me on Twitter or something that resonated with me, said if he was like 5% less noxious, you'd almost feel bad for him. But, right. You know, what a couple of things that stick out to me. One is the sort of detail that you guys go into about Alex, you know, by all appearances, surveilling his wife, suspecting her of having an affair or seeing somebody else, but also texting somebody else and saying things like, what was it? It's like, need sucky or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like
everybody's fascinated by the sucky line. So this is a I want to make something very clear here. I don't know whether his wife is cheating on him or not. So I have no idea. I only know what is Jones's interpretation of this, or what Jones is saying to his wife. We got an expert in on the issue of coercive control, which is a form of domestic violence. We talked about things like surveillance in there and how that factors into things and how accusations sometimes factor into things. So, you know, as people who have, again, I am not saying that Jones is definitely an abuser. I'm not diagnosing. I'm not doing anything. I'm just presenting the text of the facts. But something that abusers do is accuse people of the very things that they're doing. Now, it's very possible that his wife is also having an affair. I'm not invested in that story. What I'm invested in here is the fact that Jones is surveilling his wife to getting updates as to where she is and when, while he's all sneaking away to be with this married woman named Pat Johnson in the phone. And I know who Pat Johnson is. And we had to wrestle with whether we wanted to include her name. And the reason we didn't is because marriage is complex. Things happen. You know, people have affairs. These things happen. For all I know, this woman feels horrible about cheating on her husband and has already come clean about it. Or he has already found out and they've already been through it and they're reconciling right now. I don't want to be publicizing to the world that she had an affair with Alex Jones that she regrets.
Yeah, and that's not your place to get mixed in either. As a journalist, yeah. That's somebody's marriage. It's, you know, I'm sure this woman is not a public figure or anything like
She's not, and she has kids. And the other thing about it was, we did wrestle with it because she's sharing links to far right websites to him. But there's nothing else but the links that would indicate to me she shares his ideology very closely. And if you're having a relationship with somebody and you're attracted to that person, you're looking for stuff to talk about and you're looking about their interests, right? And if I'm putting myself in the mindset of somebody having an affair with Alex Jones, God, good Lord. If I'm thinking about that and I'm looking at these texts on the whole, I mean, what are Jones's interests? He doesn't like, there's no like, hey dude, are you going to see, are you going to go see Sleep Play? They're touring. There's no like things like that.
Great band. It's not, great band. Have to interrupt you. Fantastic.
Yeah. But they're not like, you know, there's no text like that. Like if you see even my text back and forth with Hannah, like there's no text like where they're like, you know, laugh my ass off with like a picture of something or like, here's a picture of a raccoon. Like there's nothing like that. And I'm trying to think of my own text. Like if I were leaked, I mean, it should be like 90% of, if it would just be like me sending close up heads of people to my friends and everyone going like, Hayden. There's nothing like, hey, what are we doing for the Cowboys game? Are you like, where are we meeting? Like, are you going to, we're going to go to the parking lot. There's no hobbies. There's no like, you know, there's nothing. Did you read this book? No, it's just InfoWars shit. So I don't know if Pat Johnson had that much to talk about with this guy and was, you know, how do I know that she's not just like, hey, I'm having an affair with this guy. I really like him. He's a lot of fun. And he's into this conspiracy stuff. So I'm sending it too. I mean, so I couldn't be the judge. I couldn't judge and say that she's into his ideology. And I'm not even sure if I know what Jones's ideology is anymore.
So moving on from this, you know, did he or didn't he affair situation? Some other details in the story. One of them has to do with pornography. And Jones sending sexually explicit images or links to sexually explicit things to other contacts in his phone, which, you know, plenty of people, again, it's one of these things, like plenty of people look at pornography. Everyone has their own sexual attractions and preferences and whatever. But in public, Jones's comments about pornography seem to go like quite the opposite direction from what may or may not be his own.
I could do an personal interest podcast in it, right? My thoughts about pornography. Because it's complex, right? And I think that the short thing to say is that it's not always good for you. It's not always bad for you. And I don't have any judgment to make on people looking at pornography at all, and would be in no position to do so. I don't care that Alex Jones looks at pornography. So why include it? It was essential to include it because these issues of sexual shaming are so important to InfoWars. It is like the bulk of almost every single thing he does is stigmatizing, perceived enemies along their lines of sexuality. And a big part of that is around pornography. So he'll bring people out like E. Michael Jones, who is an anti-Semite, and you know this very well, that they, like a big radical right talking point is that Jewish people created pornography, to weaken white men, white non-Jewish men, and to access them and, make them impotent and whatever else. Like, it's a mind control thing. And this is like a big talking point. This was huge. That did a big... You recall, like in 2018, I think you were in the swamp covering it at that time. Like, there was a big thing like counteracting like No Nut November they were No Nut November, whatever. They were joining the radical right, was mixed in with these people who were the no pornography, no masturbation crowd. You remember that?
Yeah. Like the Proud Boys,
the No Wanks.
At least at some point, if they don't still today, have guidance for their members not to masturbate, which is just one baby step further than don't watch.
And that's the reason why it matters, because Jones is on the air and he is talking about how pornography is, in so many words, mind control, and it's meant to destroy families, is the literal quote, and about how he doesn't use it. And then getting off the air, and within it's within a short amount of time, is sending a link to a pornographic video. And the type of stuff that he describes as being like the horrors of what's really in pornography, like women being used like a beef tenderizer and whatever else, is like the way he describes it. And look, the stuff that he was sharing in those videos was, exactly as he describes.
And then sort of a last detail that sticks out to me from that first part in the series has to do with Alex Jones's alcohol consumption, which is, it kind of just struck me as sad, I guess. A lot of people struggle with alcohol. It's one of those things that we sell in society and sort of normalize, even though it's like addictive and stuff. And some people can get lost in it, just judging from the text and how often Alex is asking people to bring him vodka. I'm thinking of footage from like different interviews that people have done with Alex through the years where he's drinking a lot. There was the surveillance footage of that got leaked out somewhere, if I remember correctly, where Alex is drinking a lot.
Yeah, Zach Drucker is a mini scoop in there, is that Zach Drucker actually leaked the video, and he's one of the sources who told us about Inside InfoWars. And he kind of came to us after.
Yeah, it's what are we to make of that? I mean, all of this kind of chalks up to paint a picture of Alex as somebody who is completely disingenuous, which I think that most people could probably guess, if not assume, about Alex. But also as somebody who, is having, trying to fight that on-air persona against a life that is full of, by my interpretation at least, of just sort of like self-torture to some degree, paranoia over his wife. Yeah. you know, this, you know, very conflicting things about it, what he's saying on air and his own things like regarding pornography. And then also this.
But also yeah. Sexuality as well. I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, oh, he's bisexual. He's not. It's not my, you know, that's for each of us to make a decision, you know, how we describe ourselves and what our experiences are like. But I mean, it's clearly, you know, he's clearly much more open to non-heteronormative sex, you know, based upon that. And also the incident where he had trans feminine performer Marissa Minx on his phone, mm-hmm. if you recall, 2018, like all that stuff is very different from the rhetoric around calling LGBTQ people pedophiles, right? Which
yeah.
he's the godfather.
Yeah, he's been doing that forever.
So yeah, I mean, regarding the alcohol and bringing it back there, look, we had, you know, once we went through this, we'd look at what the stories might be. And we knew that they would be really self-contained, unfortunately, right? Like we couldn't like, these were not the type of texts that were going to be like, you know, bombshell and get like a bunch of re-reporting and like everywhere else. Like, you know, there's no like Russia contact or something, right? But what it did show, and that we really wanted to convey is a clear warning to people who want to go this way and make money in this world, that it is not pleasant. It is really bad. It is not a happy life. You can make a lot of money, and Jones really has. He really has made a lot of money. I think Gavin McGinnis has probably made his share of money too, but it's not pleasant. It's an unpleasant life. And I have no doubt that Jones is drinking, which is, according to some of his ex-employees in this, starts around 9 a.m. You know, I have no doubt that he's self-medicating in part because of these, the double lives that he has to lead here. You know, the kind of strain of like keeping it up. The inability to show weakness, this need to be an alpha male, this kind of like male supremacist worldview that he inhabits, than so many of these guys inhabit, this desire to be an alpha, right? It's like, you know, like that's why the cuck porn thing was so interesting to me, because it's like, well, it's like, okay, cuck porn, but like, you know, your whole thing is that you're the alpha male, you're the guy who understands everything. It's like, I think a lot of people who are more open about how their feelings around sexuality and things like that, who may like this stuff or whatever, you know, would say that they, you know, that they're playing with the idea of, you know, of female empowerment or whatever. In his case, he's really like in a lot of pain, and who he is does not measure up to the character he plays on his show. And because of that, I really think that the drinking is a bit of self-medication.
To put it in Alex's own words, I am in hell. So part two came out yesterday as we're recording this. This one focused on his ties to the Proud Boys. We can kind of go through this one pretty quick, being conscious of time here. But, you know, Jones yeah. is seen texting with Gavin McInnes, the Canadian news personality who started the Proud Boys and for all intents and purposes is still sort of the de facto leader, even if it's not on paper anywhere. And something that stood out to me, something that, you know, I remember seeing Rex Jones, which is Alex's son, kind of mingling with Gavin, you know, back in the day. But what I didn't realize and what I learned from these text messages is that Alex and Gavin were in communication talking about, you know, some way to give Rex Jones his own type of career, his own kind of like media stardom, which was really interesting to me because something I think about a lot with Alex and like looking at the rest of the InfoWars bench is that there still really isn't anyone in Alex's mix that I think can truly pick up the mantle from him. And if there was anybody yeah. who could, I would imagine that shaping his son up to be, you know, to sort of take over his throne would be one of those things. And the fact that he's enlisting the founder of a hate group to, you know, experiment with that idea, even though, you know, it doesn't really seem to have gone anywhere at this point, that was really interesting to me.
We're behind on an audio clip of that. I know that I probably got an email while we're in this podcast. I'll add it to my Twitter thread from that story. And we're going to put it in the story just so you can hear what Gavin says, like with his own words. I hate to, like, you know, apologize for anybody who says anything at any point, but I actually do feel bad for Rex Jones. We don't get to choose who our fathers are. And he's been on InfoWars, did you know, since he's like 12, you know, and this is not a world I would want my children to be in. You know, I have sons of my own, and I can't imagine letting them into that world. I think that I think it's good to prepare children for some adult realities, but the world of InfoWars is so dark and horrid and bigoted and.
It's grim. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's so crazy. Filled with, yeah, it's grim. And this guy never had a chance is what I'm saying. And so he's 17 years old and he's trying to be an influencer. And it's really painful to hear him admit to Gavin McGinnis, like say, I was addicted to pornography. I did have a addiction problem with, you know, because he's wrestling, I'm sure in his own mind where he's, you know, a boy like on the internet and dealing with this stuff, and then also hearing his father's show. I mean, it's like, can you imagine that world where you're getting two different messages around this? So Gavin kind of just takes him on, and they do this very cringe one-on-one interview, and he basically tells him that like 95% of women who report rape are faking it in order to get back at a man. And then he says he'd never met anybody who ever really did domestic violence. And he's like, oof. It's harsh. And it's hard to hear. And I think that the most important thing, and I know we're going to wrap up on this, but the most important thing for this whole series, and I should preview the other stories quickly, if you want to do that after this, but I think the most important thing here is this male supremacist angle, this misogyny, because not to be you know, too woke myself here, but I did have an experience reading this that kind of changed me a little bit in the sense that, like, I felt like a little upset at myself that I had repeatedly there, as you know, there's misogyny in
right
everything we cover, right? Everything in this world, you can't cover this beat without, there's no one in there you're like, well, this person's not a misogynist, so actually it's a little different. You know maybe some stuff on Countercurrents doesn't bother with women. If you really know your stuff, you'll understand why that's a funny joke, but you know, most of the time misogyny is just really deeply embedded in all of this.
Any form of supremacy, I feel like I'm always usually has at least some element of that.
Yeah. And what I realized is reading this, it's also the way they talk about women, but also the way they treat women. And the pain it brings on the men themselves also to do this, right? Because it's you're just destroying everything. By living this way. And it really made me want to pay much more attention and highlight and bring up higher in stories how women are treated, because I was so repelled by what I read in this stuff. It just made me very angry and sad, and it made me want to do whatever I could to do better about this. It's like not performative male feminism, but just try to, you know, I feel like a responsibility as a writer to do better with this. And Rachel Yannick, who is my editor on this, I asked her, you know, like, this is what we're seeing. Can you help? Because she's really cares about this. And she did a really fantastic job.
So Mike, as we're wrapping up here, You know, zooming out on this series, two of the five stories plus the part zero are already out. This episode is going to come out Monday. What else is in the pipe? What should people be watching from Hate Watch? You know, what else is there to learn from these text messages sent to and from Alex Jones?
Okay, so I will tell you, I'll just roll it out here. I don't know if I'm supposed to tease the whole thing, but
Posting through it exclusive.
Part three, we are doing Joe Rogan and Andrew Tate because they kind of fit together in this story. And I think people are going to find, guess what? More themes, more of the same themes, male supremacy. Then we're doing this is one for the real heads, which is Alex Jones was warned about Nick Fuentes before he started to form his relationship with him. As we now know, 2 years later, he proceeded beyond the warning. When I warning, I mean, he was warned. He's like, yeah, hey, this guy really likes Hitler. And he's like, it was like, I can't tell you. All right, I'll just say, but he basically like, I got a feeling that this guy is an FBI informant, and he's like, yeah, definitely a trap for sure.
Oh my God.
And as we know, he continues on and he's just like, yeah, we love Nick. Nick's our guy, despite all this. And then the last one I think is the one that'll have as much depth as the first one, which only focuses on his business stuff. And that is like, Megan was really working hard on that. And if you've ever felt like you've been cheated by Ticketmaster, by the dentist, by your car dealership, repairers, whatever, your eyes are going to open when you find out what's going on in InfoWars and the way they view their customers. I mean, it is like, you know, like cartoons of the wolf, like licking and drooling. Like it is like, boy, they are carving these people up.
Oh man. I, as somebody who is currently wrangling with an auto body shop, definitely interested in that because
those people are saints. There's nothing worse than that, right? I mean, like that's enough to that's radical. That's a radicalizing experience dealing with insurance company over health insurance, car dealership, like, you know, like especially like when you start budgeting more, like when you got it, like family budget, house, but I mean, it's like all of a sudden you're like, really? How much are we gonna haggle over this much? That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, how many like hundreds of dollars do I pay you every month? And then, you know, I roll up for the first time in like 5 years and I'm like, hey, you know, all that money I gave you? Yeah. So I need to fix a little something on my car. And then they're like, I don't know. Can you send us pictures? I don't know. Why is the shop charging that much? And it's like, I don't fucking know why the shop is charging this much. All I know is it needs to get fixed, man.
At least it's not a Tesla.
Yeah. Oh my God. Anyway, Mike, thanks for coming on the show this week. Last question everybody gets. You've been on the show many times, so you know what I'm about to ask you. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Favorite thing on the internet right now I need to just get the actual account name because I retweet it all the time. A few people who follow me are not going to be surprised about this. I just need the at real quick. It's the Goth Music Videos Twitter account. And I will say this because the person who runs it, and the reason why I love this, I don't just want to speak, I'm 43. I'm going to turn 44 pretty soon. So this is I'm an older guy on this beat now. And hold on, I'll just type it in here real quick. And what I like about it is this person is a young person. It's at goth_videos. This person is clearly a young person who is interpreting some of the music that was old for me when I was a kid. Like I don't, you know, I was 90s music, and these are like all 80s songs. And the way this person posts about it is so adorable. Just like with these memes about, you know, like turning from 2023 to 1980. It's great. And I just love it. And they have very good taste. And it's lovely. I also like correcting the account too, because I'll be like, they'll post something and I'll be like, that's not goth. Like they're posting a fall. I'm like, technically we didn't call that a goth band before, but yeah, anyway, I just love the account. And it is how I feel. I feel like, you know, I need goth stuff these days, because I just feel like the material we cover, I just need to wash it out with that.
My favorite thing on the internet right now, after being really skeptical and hesitant, I started watching the series on Netflix about Formula One racing. And after a couple episodes, I'll be damned if they didn't get me to care about guys who are racing cars worth more than any house I will ever hope to own.
Wow.
So it's really, it's compelling. It's, I don't know what it is, but, you know, just really engaging. So I would recommend that one.
Oh, I need some of that. Let's do it.
Yeah. Just that pure, like, cathartic, you know, nothing to do with anything about our work. Just some guys driving race cars.